Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Anne.
How are you?
I'm all right. I'm looking out my window at snow everywhere here in Brookline, Massachusetts. But
I want snow. We need a little more snow out here in Madison, Wisconsin.
Sorry.
So we can get our ski trails going.
It's very beautiful.
Yeah, I like the snow. We need more.
Yeah.
We were forced to go sledding the other day because our cross-country ski trails weren't what they need to be.
I see. Well, anyway, let's introduce ourselves. I'm Glenn Lowry, professor at Brown University.
And I'm a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison at the law school here. So,
yeah.
So the professors are here to talk about the Tucson Massacre.
Do we have to?
I mean, think we do.
Okay, I feel very inexpert. And I'm, at the moment like this, especially mindful of the fact that there's just so much talk in our public culture, you know, and we're part of it. I mean, blogging mm-hmm. heads, blogging this, op-ed that, TV commentary, cable news. Every event has to be instantly analyzed by people who don't have, with due respect, the depth of, you know, usually any kind of real depth or sophistication or whatever. No time for reflection. Talk. So
mm-hmm.
we're going to add to it.
One of President Obama's themes at the memorial the other night was humility, that we should, when we talk about this, have a dose of humility, he said. And I still think we need to criticize the people who jumped in right at the beginning with a lack of humility. I think that he was maybe pushing back some of the people that got started right in the beginning, before anything was known about what happened, and suddenly had all kinds of theories about why it happened that I think were just insane. Now, it turned out that apparently, from what we can tell at this point, it was a lone gunman who genuinely was insane. So there's a certain irony in it. I would say that the commentators themselves were ideating in a paranoid fashion, connecting up things that they didn't really know about to form a nice conspiratorial theory that made sense of everything.
So let me be clear. You don't think we are experiencing a climate of hate? Or you don't think that whatever climate of hate we might be experiencing had anything to do with the behavior of this of Jared Lee Loughner?
Right. Yeah, and I think it would be really wrong to let the fact that one crazy guy acted out change the way we speak and the way we behave in American democracy. We just had an important election. We just had a tremendously profound grassroots movement. We have a
Tea Party.
Mm-hmm. We have a vibrant, very significant debate about policy in America. We have a new Congress. We have important issues that we need to talk about as sane people in the real world. I think to become distracted by what went on in the mind of a man who has something, I think, quite wrong with his brain is something that would only be suggested by people who don't want to continue with the normal politics that they're confronted with. So I think I can understand why some people disappointed with what happened in the last election, are interested in seizing upon this distraction. But I think the rest of us should resist that and should. I noticed in Paul Krugman's column today in the New York Times that he, or the first one that he had over the weekend right after the massacre, that he was suggesting that it would be wrong for people to just keep doing what they've been doing after what happened in Tucson. But I disagree with that. I think we should keep doing what we've been doing and that, you know, we should always mourn people who die and see the significance of the individual and be sad and have memorials for people who die. I think that's important. I think we should care about violence in the world. We should be concerned about the mentally ill. But it's not a major topic in the current political debate that a huge effort has been made over the last 2 years to engage people in and has brought many people in to raise as many important issues in the real sane world of normal people.
Hold on. This is a torrent of different concepts, all of which are interesting. Can you give me a chance to just tease them out?
Sure. Yes.
So we can explore them. Okay.
Tease away.
Is there anything wrong with the political discourse, the climate of discourse? I'm just going to list some questions. I don't mean for you to answer them immediately.
Mm-hmm.
One question is, what about the climate? Has it gotten out of hand? Is talk radio too bellicose? Is there insufficient respect for people with whom one disagrees? Has the loss of civility somehow diminished the quality or character of our public discourses in a dysfunctional way? Another has to do with whether or not the gunman who acted out of political or some other motives. Another has to do with the commentators who, liberal commentators, if I may say so. Paul mm-hmm. Krugman is a liberal. Paul Krugman supports the Democratic Party. Paul Krugman hates the Tea Party. Keith Olbermann hates the Tea Party. Keith Olbermann is a liberal. He evidently votes Democratic. Chris Matthews gets a chill up his leg when he thinks about Obama, this kind of thing. So these are partisan actors, no less partisan than Fox News, I might point out, who seize upon an incident for their own purposes. And yet another issue, this would be a fourth one now that we might explore, is the meaning of the Tea Party. I mean, you see grassroots activism there. You see something that is glorious about democratic self-government in the Tea Party, whatever you may think about their particular, you know, political views. But many other people see something really quite ugly. They don't see anything to be celebrated. You know, they're not like saying, engagement again, people back out at meetings again, people, you know, around their kitchen tables talking about government again, hurrah. No, they're saying, you know, that the Tea Party is a threat, that these people are crazy, they characterize them as birthers, they dismiss them as being idiots, they, et cetera, et cetera. So,
I think there's a big difference between the kind of crazy that we see among people who are basically sane, but they believe, maybe they think they have birther theories or truther theories, and people believe all manner of flaky spiritual concepts these days, and they don't believe in science, or they believe in this. But those are not mentally ill people. And I think we should have the debate about how crazy some of those ideas and call people when they go over the line and are too hateful and violent. And there's some of that, whether there's more today than there was in the past or whatever. I don't think there is that much more. I think there's always a certain amount of emotional vibrancy going on, and some people go too far and some people say crazy things. But there's a difference between that and a genuinely psychotic person who is not in the real world, who doesn't, apparently this man didn't really even believe the world was real. He thought he was in an unreal dream.
Yeah.
Where nothing mattered.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, from all we
know,
that's
not the same.
We don't know as much as we're going to know in a week or a month's time. From all we know, this was a deranged person who acted on, you know, his mentally distorted thoughts and acted out violently. For all we know, I mean, and a number of the defenders of Tea Party enthusiasts have said this in the press, you know, the guy had no particular political identity, didn't listen to talk radio, he was not mm-hmm. a devotee of Tea Party politics or Glenn Beck, whatever. He's just a very disturbed individual who found it amazingly easy to get his hands on a semi-automatic weapon and a 30-bullet clip and went out and killed people. So,
he manifested his insanity quite a bit around other people for a long period of time.
Yeah.
And we don't have the culture or the mechanisms in place to stop someone like that before they act.
That's yet another
issue. I think that the concerns about guns and the concerns about how we treat the mentally ill are what the massacre should put to the front of the stage. I don't think that it should be connected with politics or with things about hateful speech or the civility material or the Tea Party. I think those things are interesting too, but I think it's just wrong. It's just irrational. It's participating in the same paranoid style of reasoning to connect what Jared Loeffner did with these other events. I mean, it just looks opportunistic. No,
it's opportunistic.
And shameful
that's the word.
For that reason. But that's, it also just doesn't make sense.
The word I was searching around for was opportunistic, and it seems to me precisely mm-hmm. so. Just like it's opportunistic to seize upon someone's public statement that we may need to reform entitlements and accuse them of wanting to send old people out into the cold without health care. Just like it's opportunistic to seize upon someone's thought that end-of-life medical care decisions should be made rationally and to seize upon that and characterize them as favoring death panels to pull the plug on grandma. I mean, there's enough opportunism to go around on both sides of the aisle, no?
Yeah. Yeah, I would rather promote clear critical thinking and rationality than civil speech and politeness and that kind of etiquette of speech. I think it's fine for people to speak in an emotional way and to use colorful and exaggerated and comical forms of speech.
Violent,
I don't see the problem
violent
with that.
Metaphors of violence?
Oh,
I want to
violent.
Put a bullet in the brain of somebody?
I think if you say I want to kill
metaphorically
somebody.
Metaphorically speaking.
I think there's a lot of metaphor, a lot of the normal metaphor, like even words like a battleground state or campaign is actually a war term. If you try to extract the metaphors from speech, I mean, speech is just loaded, to use a term, with dead metaphors and semi-metaphors and semi-automatic metaphor. And you just can't take that out of speech unless your goal really is to keep people from being able to speak or to trip people up every time they try to talk by saying, oh, now you've said something violent. Sure, there are more direct things that are really advocating violence, and those should be singled out. But this war on metaphor, to coin a phrase, it's ridiculous. I take arms against the war and metaphor.
Okay. So you don't think there's a problem with the quality of our political discourses. You don't think that the 24/7 news cycle is debasing our political discussion. You don't think that the partisan personalities like a Glenn Beck or, a O'Reilly or an Oberman or something are a problem? You think everything's okay on
that front? I think it's the great American tradition of vigorous debate. I think you can go back to Thomas Paine. I think it's what we do in America, and I don't think it should be. I don't think it should be denounced.
Okay, now let me push back a little bit. Actually, I think I agree with you almost 100%. But I did actually sit down and watch a Glenn Beck show. A few months
I can't
ago.
Take Glenn Beck myself.
So I mean, I just watched it. I just wanted to see what was going on there. And I was stunned at the demagogue, what felt to me like a kind of oily, slick, manipulative, ugly demagoguery. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really didn't like it. The insinuations about, socialism and communism and the numerology, borderline numerology, conspiracy theories, the little blackboard with the circles and the arrows and the scribbled phrases, and this guy prancing around.
Why do you think that
works on people? The drama, the rising pitch of the voice, and then the quiet whisper, and the, unnerved me. Okay, saying this from I'm against the right wing posture. I'm saying this from intelligent observer of public discourses, and I don't like slick TV preachers who market the gospel with their shark skin suits any more than I like the way that this guy markets the right-wing political line with the buy gold to protect yourself against the coming apocalypse commercials interspersed in between. I mean, there's just something very unnerving about it.
But isn't it a long-standing American tradition? I mean, the preachers.
I don't make it right.
Jeremiah Wright. I mean, there are people the right and left.
There's a certain
kind of populist rhetoric. It's part entertainment. It's part ideas. There are different tastes in that. For example, I listen to Rush Limbaugh. I like Rush Limbaugh. I really enjoy listening to Rush Limbaugh. But I can't watch Glenn Beck. I mean, to me, Glenn Beck is kind of a little slow. It's a little weird. I don't like his style, but I know people who like that style. I mean, I try to understand what is it about that is appealing to people.
He also uses this Christian imagery. He uses this pray on your knees, this kind of... There was a feeling of almost like a revival meeting. I mean, my mention of the televangelist was not accidental. It reminded me a little bit of that.
Well, I mentioned Jeremiah Wright. What about that? I mean, to bring someone in from the left.
I kind of defended Jeremiah Wright in a way in that I know the genre. In other words, I know kind of like where he's coming from because I grew up on the south side of Chicago. And I know Jeremiah Wright actually not well, but I know him. But I know many people who go to his church, and I know many people who are like him, and I mean, like him in the way in which they talk about, in the sharp-edged way in which they talk about their disagreement with, sort of mainstream tendencies in American political culture from a kind of Afrocentric, outsider-looking in point of view. And I defended it, not because it's going to sell on Main Street. Definitely a presidential candidate doesn't want to be saddled with that kind of thing because it's not going to sell on Main Street. But because I thought it was indicative of a corner of American, you know, expression, namely South Side of Chicago, urban, African-American, alienated, angry left, that is just as much a part of this as the NRA out there in South Dakota is a part of this great country. And shouldn't have been dismissed out of hand as wacky, crazy, or whatever, but should have been understood, you know, within its kind of cultural and historical context as one voice of many different voices. This one a little scratchy, a little loud, a little sometimes disquieting, but nevertheless, in some sense, legitimate. That's what I thought. I thought Jeremiah Wright's outbursts were, you know, a legitimate part of the discourse, even if I didn't agree with everything that he was saying.
I think that if we go too far in the direction of this civility and etiquette, we're kind of privileging some people over others. We're privileging people who are more educated, people who come from a background where politeness and niceness is the cultural style, and delegitimizing people who come from a different sort of culture where maybe exaggeration and harsh speech is the thing, people who use more imagery. And that's on the left and the right. I just don't want to delegitimate a kind of a style of speech and a vibrancy of speech. I think that it's appealing to some people on the left right now to do that because of the Tea Party movement and because of the results of the next election. But you know they're going to look like hypocrites very soon, or at least eventually, because they're going to be back to criticizing the government and saying their outlandish things and wanting to go see the new Michael Moore movie or whatever. I mean, there's always things like that. I just think it's a swipe at people who think in more colorful, artistic, comical, satirical ways and so forth. This idea that we need to control the speech in order to get at the truly violent people, I just don't think it even works. I mean, I think that, in fact, if there were some speech that we know that Jared Lautner, we don't know, but it seems that Jared Lautner didn't watch TV, didn't listen to the radio, actually didn't get drawn in by Rush Limbaugh or Michael Moore or Glenn Beck or any of these people.
Right.
So if you wanted to think, what would a marginal person like that, who really was questioning whether there was any meaning anywhere, and was, you know, maybe, I mean, I think he's diseased and nothing would have brought him back, but if, imagine a kind of an outsider, a loner person who's looking for something to grasp onto, what would it be that would reach out to him? It probably wouldn't be the most bland, polite, nice person explaining things in a completely reasonable, rational way. It probably would be someone with a more comical, outlandish, exaggerated form of expression. So I think actually people like Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, Jeremiah Wright, whoever, may actually be effective in bringing in people who would otherwise not pay attention to politics. And even if it isn't completely rational, it actually, just bringing people in and getting them talking and interacting with other human beings, rather than being completely isolated, can be more effective in socializing and making people more normal and less crazy. So I don't even buy the theory that it's polite civil speech that will make us all better. Because, I mean, I know, I'm a 60-year-old professor, and I still, I'm disgusted by, like, overly nice, insipid speech. I want there to be some bite in it. So what about all of these young people who might have a tendency to stray off into violence? I don't think more civil speech is really what's going to keep us safe. I think the sort of free market of vigorous ideas, including lies and outrageous statements, although not direct incitements to violence, are more helpful in normalizing more people.
Let me ask you this. Suppose that Jared Lee Loeffner had been a member of the Tea Party. Suppose he had been a devoted follower of Rush Limbaugh or Glenn Beck or somebody. Suppose he was a registered Republican. Suppose he had a strongly articulated pro-life position, low taxes, et cetera, et cetera. Would it then be okay for Paul Krugman to write a column saying, in effect, that Sarah Palin and Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh had caused the attempted murder of a member of the Congress and the senseless murder of other individuals? Would it then be okay to lay responsibility at the feet of the political party which this fellow followed? Let him be just as deranged, just as disconnected, just as disjointed, but let him have a political identity. Would it be all right to engage in that kind of collective imputation of responsibility. What do you think?
I would want to know more detail about where he heard the message. I mean, you know, the son of Sam heard the dog next door telling him to commit murder. If someone listens to Sarah Palin and imagines that Sarah is telling him to go kill somebody, and he's thinking that because he's schizophrenic, I don't think that's Sarah Palin's fault. How could anyone dare speak, lest some crazy person take it the wrong way?
I recall the Prime Minister of Israel having been assassinated, Rabin, by a gentleman who, if I'm not mistaken, was significantly influenced by some of the preaching of Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox rabbis in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Is it within the realm of legitimate discourse? I simply don't know. This is really a question about which you may have more information than me.
Well,
to then carry that into the explicit political debate, which is quite vigorous in Israel about the future of the occupied territories and so forth, and discredit the ultra-right wing because of the actions of this individual?
I would like to know the actual details. If I remember correctly, when Rabin was assassinated, it was after there had been talk of people openly saying he should be assassinated.
Yep.
And so that was definitely wrong. That's different from anything you could say the Tea Party did. I've always thought this meme.
Okay, so there's a line. I'm just trying to see where the line is. I thought so. Yeah. That case did seem to me, and I don't know a whole lot about it, to be on the other side of the line in terms of a national discourse about really deeply felt issues that has flirted with intimations of violence and that then resulted perhaps in some awful act. That's on the other side of the line. We're way short of that line, you feel.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think, look at all the hatred that is aimed at Sarah Palin, for example. Now, there are death threats against Sarah Palin. Let's say Sarah Palin were to be assassinated. Then what would you say
heaven
about
forbid.
The people on the left? Yeah, heaven forbid, and I hate to even say, I feel like all the mere fact
even,
that I mentioned it is maybe some crazy person is watching this. And if so, let me just say, don't kill anyone. You know, just as a general rule, if your ideas seem to lead to killing someone, think again. That's not right. You're right. Go back. Think of something else. That's
okay,
wrong.
But
I mean, the hatred that is being, and also the hatred against George Bush that was out there.
Yeah.
And by the way, considering all the hatred, if it were really true that the vigorous discourse, the vicious, hateful discourse, inspired murder, there'd be a lot more murders of politicians than we're currently seeing. I think we should step back and observe what doesn't happen, which is that there is a lot less violence than there would be if the theories being spouted here were true. I think the evidence is that the speech doesn't cause the violence. I think the speech is a safeguard. It's a release vent for people. And also because it's tied to democracy that can actually work, as seen in the last election, you don't need the violence. That's the point of democracy and of free speech. I think we should reaffirm the value of free speech here.
Okay. No argument with you on that. But I want to ask about blood libel. I mean, we were mentioning Sarah Palin.
Yeah.
Okay. So now there's
this
firestorm. Well, what I think is I didn't get it. I mean, first of all, I didn't get the, she used a phrase that referred to something that happened to Jews in the history of Europe and anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. Therefore, somehow that's out of bounds. I didn't understand that at all.
You're not allowed to.
When I heard the words, I didn't think Middle Ages and matzah. I thought libel and blood. In other words, I took it literally. She's being libeled. I thought she was saying I'm being libeled by people who are accusing me of being responsible for something that I haven't had nothing to do with. That's libelous. And it had to do with the spilling of blood. I mean, that's what I thought. Now I don't know what might have been in her head, but the commentary then went off into this thing of she's invoked this phrase. It's like she's calling herself a victim equivalent to, Jews in the history of anti-Semitism and how dare her. And I thought that was hysterical, frankly. I mean, I'm not Jewish, and I don't, so what do I know?
About it in comparison to using the term slavery. If someone says, I'm a wage slave at my job.
It would be hysterical then for a bunch of people to start running around saying, oh my God, she's comparing herself to a slave, she's making herself into a victim, and she's disrespecting the history of this awful institution. That would be absurd.
I think that's the analogy. It would be to say, oh, someone used the word slavery to refer to their job, and that is that's horrible. That doesn't give the proper respect and significance to what we know slavery really was. And the term slavery should only be used in the context of the actual phenomenon that was slavery, and nothing else can ever be compared to
it. Yeah, and that's absurd. I mean, now, I don't want to accuse anybody of, inappropriately, claiming sort of territoriality around a term, because I haven't heard the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith or whatever it might be come out and say Sarah Palin must not use that term. But I have seen many liberal commentators who may or may not be Jewish objecting to the fact that she used that term. And in my mind, those objections reflect desperation. I mean, it's like a grasping for straws. And they also reflect the kind of herd mentality in the media, in which a bunch of people listening to each other repeat back and forth, and they end up talking about the same inane point over and over again until the fact that they're talking about it becomes the story,
of the text that
engages their attention. So,
the word.
And by the way, I have no brief for Sarah Palin. I mean, I'm not a Tea Party devotee. I mean, it just seemed absurd to me that she would become the issue.
And ironically, if the idea was let's preserve the term blood libel to refer to this one specific thing that it was used to mean historically that's really important and people should know that term and use it only for this one thing, well, the very people who said that were really opportunistically using that term that they wanted to keep kind of sacred and special, using it as just another thing to throw at Sarah Palin because they love throwing at Sarah Palin whatever they opportunistically can find to throw at her. And then ironically, it backfired because now if you look up this term blood libel that people wanted to restrict to this historical slander against the Jews, if you look it up, what you see all over the front page of your Google results will be Sarah Palin, now the most known connection with the words blood libel is Sarah Palin. Look what you've done. That's great. If you wanted to keep it pure and sacrosanct, it totally backfired.
Okay.
That's the way Google works.
Here's another topic in the same general area, which was the president's speech, which has been very well received.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think? Not so much of the speech, although, of course, feel free to comment on that. I mean, I'll say for my own part that it was a very good speech. I thought very effective speech, and so most of the commentary has concluded. But what about the applause, the setting, the audience? And what about the post-speech commentary in which many people were rushing to say, Obama's got his mojo back, Obama the healer, and things of this kind? Reactions?
I was just listening to Rush Limbaugh, what he was saying about, I don't really watch any TV commentary. I just can't I just can't tolerate it. But from what Rush Limbaugh said, and I do listen to Rush, he said that on Fox they were all saying what a good speech it was, but over on CNN they were all saying it wasn't good and he didn't do what he was supposed to do. So what's with that?
I don't know, but I thought the jury was pretty much in, and I haven't done any systematic investigation that it was a pretty good speech. I guess I missed the CNN. I mean, there was some criticism about the applause and the sort of pep rally or campaign-like feel that the setting and the interruption of at certain points with applause engendered. The president couldn't control that, and I don't think he was entirely comfortable with it.
Yeah,
some have said
that
he might have, admonished the audience or, asked them to tone it down, to withdraw their demonstrations because that was inappropriate to the setting. But I don't think you can hold it against him for not having improvised that one on the cuff. He couldn't really control the setting or the audience's response.
Well, maybe the president should have more image control and should have his people. I didn't really read the details of it, but I noticed he didn't have the usual teleprompter. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a little awkward. There was too much introductions by the university president.
Yeah, I saw that.
And there was the speech was a little too long, but it was lengthened by the applause, and they didn't need to be in a sports arena. You have a bunch of students in a sports arena, they're probably going to behave the way, I mean, they're so far from the scene of the action. It's not the same as having it in a memorial service in a cathedral where the architecture
the solemnity of the setting
affects the way
a certain,
people
yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, that was kind of understood that somebody chose the arena. My husband had trouble watching because he couldn't take the applause. He just thought it was so inappropriate for a memorial service. He had to leave the room. I sat and watched the whole thing. What bothered me was the way they had that black barrier up surrounding, I guess it was the victim's family. I came in kind of a little in the middle, though I saw the whole president speak. Couldn't understand why, you know, the president and the officials were over here on this one side, and then there was this black curtain barrier, and then the family was inside that. Was that so we wouldn't look at them as they were suffering in their grief, but we could still see them? Or was it so they couldn't look at the president? I just couldn't understand what that was. So the optics of that.
Now, there were a number of shots of Michelle Obama comforting what I assumed to be the spouse of the congresswoman, or am I correct about that?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, those were touching and moving in a way. And I, you know, again, mm-hmm. I would never impugn the motive of you know, people who have this awesome responsibility of, you know, conducting this kind of national ceremony. And, you know, she was appropriately comforting and empathetic. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, they're probably in a situation where anything they do would leave them susceptible to some kind of criticism or another. So I'm loath to make too much out of that. On the other hand, I must say that in some of the commentary after the speech, I detected a kind of, Obama's got his mojo back, the president's on a roll. He had a great, lame duck session, and now he's, you know, come out and given a wonderful speech that seemed a little bit unseemly to me, actually. I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, I see what you're saying. You think it's unseemly because, after all, it's a memorial. It should be about the wounded and the dead.
Indeed. And the president did what he was supposed to do.
Oh, can Obama get back in the...
You know, he did what he was supposed to do, and hurrah! I mean, and yes, he is a dignified presence, and he was a you know, healer in chief is what one of the headlines I saw was reading, and you know, that is his job at such a time, to do such a thing, and he did it, no problem. But then I think that should be it. I mean, you know, spending 20% of your broadcast after the fact praising him for doing the job and making it be about him just seemed to me to be, I don't know, again. In the aftermath of a shellacking in an election, we in the mainstream media are all too eager to extol the virtues of our great president, who is intelligent and articulate. And you see, the next 2 years bode much better than the last two. And so that just rubbed me the wrong way, I must say.
Yeah. Well, I don't like to see, I just don't think it works for these news people. It's one of the reasons I don't watch the TV news. I can't stand that it's so obvious that they're trying to help him. Could they at least be a little more subtle about it? I mean, speaking of civility and toning down rhetoric, could you tone down the rhetoric about promoting the president and give a little bit more of an impression of being a neutral journalist or thoughtful commentators or something like that? But I wanted to ask you what you thought about the religious aspects of the memorial. I mean, to some extent, it was not religious. Then there were some other odd things. I didn't see the beginning, but apparently there was some kind of Native American shaman going on.
Oh, I saw that. That was really quite interesting. I heard it on the radio, actually. I was in my car as the thing was starting. I saw that. It was quite extensive, this Native American religious invocation. He talked about relationship to the animals and to nature. I don't know a lot about Native American religion in that part of North America, so I can't get into the specifics. But I mean, it went on for some time. I thought it was interesting, and the question that it raised in my mind was: does this happen at ceremonies, public ceremonies in that part of the country? On other occasions, you know, maybe this is a part of the public culture of the Southwest that I just don't know anything about. Because after all, you know, American civilization there is built on the ruins of, you know, another culture, and paying respect for it. I was once at a conference in Sydney, Australia, and the conference was opened by a person of Aboriginal Australian descent, who invoked some, you know, called attention to the fact that the tall office building, the 40-story building that we were conferencing in, was resting on ground that had been, you know, sacred to, you know, the original people of that particular part of the world. And I thought perhaps something like that is characteristic of public culture in the Southwest.
That's possible.
If that's so, then that would perhaps account for it. But I actually don't know. It was quite noticeable, though.
One thing I think is offensive there is that there's some sort of a sense that these sort of native peoples' religions are kind of different from the religion that we worry about when we think about religion and government or separation of church and state, it's not really real religion. It's sort of a folk kind of charming. I think it's a little bit patronizing and diminishing to treat the religions, smaller religions or native religions as if, if we had a rabbi or if we had a Christian minister, that would be divisive or that would seem to be the wrong kind of mingling of church and state. But if we bring in a Native American shaman, it's not real religion. It's kind of almost like a play religion. And I think that that's disrespectful to the very people that are being
highlighted. But it wouldn't have been inappropriate to have a Christian minister or a rabbi give an invocation at a memorial ceremony, even if for a public official and even if being addressed by the president, would it?
I don't think it would, but I think that the fact that they didn't have that indicates that they think it would not be appropriate.
The native person's comparably religious, but native religion invocation would be appropriate. I see your point. Okay, let's talk about guns for a minute because we're running
out of
time.
I think you see that in schools. I think you see some classroom exercises where people do things having to do with Native American religion as if it's not really religion, so it's okay. And that it has a certain charm. And, I think there's something a little kind of wrong about that.
Yeah, pragmatically, just the pragmatic observation is if 0.2% of the population actually subscribes to the religion, then using it in that way may be less threatening to everybody else because it's less obviously an effort to impose any religious belief on anybody since it's not really a competitor for our religious affection, so to speak. You're not proselytizing when you do that. You know, you are sort of invoking something that is almost like a museum piece or something, so it doesn't have quite the same political meaning to speak in those religions. But anyway, I wanted to talk about guns just very briefly and get your no doubt interesting perspective on the debate. You know, people kill people, not guns killing people, versus the view that a guy who is obviously mentally troubled, about whom his teachers and classmates from a community college say he inspires fear, is nevertheless able to walk into, a gun store and buy a semi-automatic weapon and a clip and carry it legally without any license or, being on anybody's list. That debate, where do you come out on that?
Well, I don't think this particular guy should have been walking the streets at all. I think he should have been institutionalized. Right. If he weren't out on the street at all, he wouldn't be getting a gun. So my solution would be more toward identifying the people who are really psychologically diseased and to the point, not the normal problems we all have and not the run-of-the-mill craziness, but these people who are genuinely delusional. Need and can be identified, something ought to be done about them. I would like to see the government efforts, if there are going to be some new efforts in the wake of the massacre, be aimed in that direction rather than at gun control. For example, I think this idea of Representative Peter King, that there'd be a 1,000-foot zone around various federal officials, a gun-free zone, I think that's just absurd. I'm not a hardliner one way or the other on gun control, but I think it's if you're going to commit murder, the fact that it's also a violation of a gun law, it just seems kind of pointless.
Well,
what's the difference?
We have these shootings in the workplaces. We have these shootings at high schools and on college campuses. We have the assassination of a murder of abortion doctors and so on. And we've got a politics that's, very much infused with, right to bear arms ideology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Isn't this telling us something? Quite apart from the policy question, should it be 1,000 feet, 500 feet, or no prohibition at all? Should there be a 3-month waiting period? Should there be a review board? Should there be licensing for this or that? Should there be a limit on the size of the ammunition clip that you can purchase? Are pistols okay, but not semi-automatic pistols, and all of this kind of stuff? Quite apart from that. Isn't there something about American culture, love affair with guns, that's troubling? And isn't this idea that, oh, the criminals have guns, I have to have guns too, or this idea that someone who had been packing, if they had had their gun, they could have kept this thing. Isn't there something almost silly about this argument? Okay, now I reveal my position. Silly about this notion that if we were all armed, we'd be able to keep the criminals from doing something, whereas in my view, if we were all armed, we'd probably have 100 times as many accidental shootings of people who were thought to be a threat, but it turned out later that they were just reaching for their wallet, you know?
Everybody would be
in the position of a black teenager on a dark street at 2 a.m. in the environs of New York City, where a police officer feels that if his car, the teenager's car, is moving at too high a speed and in too irregular way, it's quite all right to open fire on them. We'd all be living under the threat of being shot down by armed vigilantes if we were to let this thing have its free reign, it seems to me.
Well, it seems to me we don't have that much shooting going on, and we have an awful lot of guns. The kind of guns that I like the way people have guns in their homes to defend themselves, so I think there's a particularly strong benefit to having people have guns in their houses. I mean, I think it deters burglary. I celebrate everybody who has a gun in their house because I think it makes it less likely. I think that the people who don't have guns in their houses are benefited by the fact that the burglars don't know where the guns are.
Well, the evidence is very, very spotty on the causal effect and diminishing crime of private gun carriage. And you say we don't have that many shootings, but as you must know, the murder rate in the United States dwarfs that. In, you know, comparable advanced Western countries in Europe or Canada or whatever. They're right across the border there in Canada. Their society is very similar to ours. They have many fewer guns in people's homes and many fewer dead people from guns. That doesn't prove anything. States with the highest gun ownership rate also have the highest murder rates, and the states with the lowest gun ownership rates have the lowest murder rates. Doesn't prove anything, but it's not consistent with the view that widespread gun ownership deters violence.
If you're going to talk about Canada, I'd like to see some more fine-grained comparisons. You're talking about a very northern climate that's more sparsely populated. Where are the murders in the U.S.? Aren't they in more concentrated metropolises? And aren't they more in the south than during the warmer weather? I think the Canadians are staying indoors more, and they're not out murdering each other. But, you know, maybe they're nicer, maybe they're more polite, maybe they resolve their disputes more amicably. But what are you going to do about all of this? We have the culture that we have, and what do you think, how do you want to try to change it?
Well, you can push against, I agree, we have the culture we have, and it's not going to change readily or easily or quickly, but you can either go with it or you can push against it. You can call us to higher ground and point out the irrationality of the way that we live and around guns and gun violence. I find it really quite irrational, but you know, we probably differ about that. Or you can sort of go with the flow and say, you know, that's the hand we've been dealt.
Well, I noticed that according to an article that was in the New York Times today that nobody or very few people in Congress want to go in the direction of gun control because obviously it's a very hot in elections, and so Democrats don't want to do it either. And Gabrielle Giffords, the woman that was shot in the massacre, she had a gun, and she was she supported gun ownership.
She did indeed.
So there are an awful lot of politicians who, whatever they would really say if they were, you know, sociologists in universities or whatever, that's not what they're saying in Congress, so I don't really think we're going to get much gun control out of this.
And then we have this amendment to our Constitution, which our Supreme Court has interpreted in the way that it has interpreted about a right to bear arms. And I must say, it just seems bizarre to me. So now we have that North Dakota or Texas or Arizona, where people may have one set of ideas about gun ownership, and there's one set of facts on the ground in terms of population density, the degree of urban concentration, etc. And you have, I don't know, Washington, D.C. or New York City, where you have a very different, you get 8 million people crammed into a limited number of square miles of space, you know, a large number of potentially violent people in their midst and so forth. And yet the same umbrella of constitutional protection forces a uniformity of law across these jurisdictions.
Here's the thing.
Yeah, break it down for me, Ann.
You're making the federalism argument, and that's something that the Supreme Court looked at just this past year when it considered whether the Second Amendment is applicable to the states through the 14th Amendment. And there was an argument that why not just let the different states and localities do it their way and adapt the law to their particular political preferences and the conditions in that particular place. There are a lot of reasons why, you know, Wyoming is different from Boston or whatever. But the interpretation of the Second Amendment that was worked through very carefully, and then a lot of people who were in favor of gun control when they did the historical research, Professor Sandy Levinson, who was on Blogging Heads a week or so ago, he's written about that. A lot of them have gone through the material very carefully and with in a spirit of neutrality and not being biased by their preference on the legislation.
Okay.
And they came to the conclusion that the Second Amendment really did represent an individual right to bear arms that goes beyond a military or a militia situation. So that's the law on the Second Amendment. That doesn't mean that the right is absolute. Some regulation is permitted, but certain kinds of really strong bans, and the court hasn't been clear about what the details are about this, but there is some individual right, but the scope of the right is left to be determined. Obviously, there's an awful lot of gun regulation, and it isn't all going to fall, but some consideration of the individual's right to defend himself, especially in the home, is something that is of a constitutional magnitude. It's in our tradition. It's in our constitutional text. And that means something. By the way, what did you think of the reading of the Constitution on the floor of the House the other day? Gabrielle Giffords read the First Amendment.
The First Amendment, yeah. I thought it was quite fine that they read the Constitution. I thought all the people were poking fun at them for reading the Constitution. I thought it was silly. I mean, it was a public relations, quote, stunt, close quote. But, I mean, you know, you could do a lot worse than reading the Constitution. Okay.
Yeah.
They're declaring their intention to, you know, their determination to, you know, bring the government in line with understanding about the Constitution. There's also this notion that every new piece of legislation has to explicitly indicate where it is that the Constitution authorizes the federal government to act in this way.
I think that's a great idea.
None whatsoever, frankly.
I mean, in the current litigation about the health care reform and challenging the individual mandate, the government switched to trying to defend it in terms of not just an exercise of the commerce power, but also as an exercise of the tax power. We were told it wasn't a tax.
If Congress had been forced to
be explicit and to say, this is a tax, that would have changed the political
discourse around health care reform.
But here they are whipping it out when it gets to the litigation phase. We weren't calling it a tax, but now we're calling it a tax.
And I got to go, and therefore I cannot allow that to be the last word. And we have to have another conversation about health care reform, because I don't necessarily accept all of what's implied by what you've just been saying, but I don't have time to rebut it.
Okay. I didn't mean to, to use an unfair tactic.
No, that's okay. That's okay. We'll talk again.
Hold up that argument. But okay. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, good talking to you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Thank you.